Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm sure you've seen the IAAF have passed new rules on testosterone levels in female competition. The new rules will come into effect from November the 1st. In short, they require women with high testosterone levels to take a pill or medication to lower testosterone levels below 5 nanomils per litre. The rule is limited to running, and it's limited again to distances between 400 metres and a mile. And these obviously narrow parameters have been widely, though not exclusively, interpreted as targeting Caster Semenya in particular. The IAAF have been accused in places of violating Semenya's human rights and even in other places of racism. Just today, a board member of the IAAF, law professor Steve Cornelius, who's from Semenya's home country of South Africa, resigned from the board, and he said in good conscience he couldn't continue his role. He said the new rule was based on the same kind of ideology that has led to some of the worst injustices and atrocities in the history of the planet. So it's an emotive issue and a complicated issue. And to discuss, scienceofsport.com is where you'll read all his work, and he's a regular on the show. Dr. Ross Tucker, hello.
Hey, Joe, how are you?
Very well. So this is complicated business, and it's very emotive. I presume the atmosphere in South Africa is slightly angry and fully behind Semenya.
Oh, yes. Semenya is enormously popular in South Africa. She has been since 2009, when she first came onto the scene in what was then a storm of controversy, and it hasn't gone away. So this is about the third or fourth installment of what's becoming a long-running saga, and the public support for her is enormous. Unfortunately, as you've just alluded to in your introduction there, sometimes I think a little bit misguided when, and I understand that, but in my opinion, there are scientific and legal issues here, and they are sometimes swept aside in the emotion and the politicization and all the other isms that sometimes factor into this. It's an impossible discussion to sometimes have with people because it's so emotive. It's sports, arguably, I think, sports most challenging problem.
Okay. I think historically it's always interesting to put these things into context. And on scienceofsport.com, you've touched on this whole area and the general timeline from the authorities' point of view. I mean, it's been an issue for a long time. This crops up in the 30s when Germans are doping, and there's the nude parade, which I can't say I had been aware of, which did exactly what it said on the tin, and was deeply unpopular, as you can imagine, but female athletes were paraded to check for male genitalia. By 1966, there was a chromosome-based test, which was done away with post-1988. It was challenged successfully, and largely it seems that post-1988, or certainly for the last 20 years, maybe up until Semenya, it's been something the IAAF have not dealt with overly stringently. They've kind of kept it at bay. I mean, that's a very broad version of things, but it's been there, is my point, for the authorities to deal with in one shape or form for a long time now.
Yeah, and it tells, I think, quite an interesting story because, as you mentioned, in the beginning, the fear was that men would disguise themselves as women in order to win medals in women's events. And so in the 1936 Olympic Games, that was the big concern. And then you must remember, though, that at that time, DNA hadn't even been identified or discovered yet, or as Watson and Crick, that was in the 1950s. So the understanding and the science of understanding these complex issues was very rudimentary. And as it evolved and as it improved, they started to add these molecular methods and scientific methods that supposedly were going to make it less invasive and less humiliating for women. But none of them have really worked. And so the nude parade was probably the low point, because what happened then was the woman had to be physically examined by a panel of doctors before they were allowed to participate. And when they discovered chromosomes and something called the chromatin test, I think they were probably quite relieved, because now suddenly we could do away with this extremely unpopular method. But it's caused itself quite a few problems. There have been athletes who've gone along to these competitions and for the first time in their mid-20s been told, actually, sorry, you failed the test, you're actually biologically male. So you can imagine what's gone on there. And this latest attempt, which really dates back to 2012, has tried to move towards looking at the hormone testosterone as the way to differentiate the two sexes for this purpose of sport. And I mean, that's where people will disagree. I thought that it was a reasonable compromise to try and find. I'm sympathetic to sport trying to manage this divide or this division between the sexes. But the testosterone approach, while a attempt at a compromise, brings with it its own problems, and that's where we are now. You know, so it's, as I say, I don't know that there's a better way to do this, and I think we are nearing the end of the attempts to do so.
Okay, because you say, Emma, you've said before that testosterone, if we're talking about men and women, testosterone is the least overlapping physical characteristic that you've encountered. It is the most obvious difference between men and women. That is why it seems we focused in on testosterone.
Yeah, certainly from a physiological, biological perspective, when we start talking about what is the biology that makes men, elite men, 10 to 12% better than elite women. So if you were to line up 10,000 people from shortest to tallest, you would get a considerable overlap between men and women. The tallest men will be in a group on their own, and the shortest people will tend to be women, but there will be considerable overlap. Now, testosterone, depending on which evidence you listen to, mm-hmm. also has some degree of overlap, but to me, as the biologist, it's one of the root causes for all the other differences. So when we talk about what makes an elite athlete who they are, hemoglobin, muscle strength, muscle mass, muscle power, all of those things can be traced back, in my opinion, to the influence of testosterone on the body as we mature. And that's why anyone watching this who's got young kids will appreciate that 10, 11-year-olds can play together, boys and girls, no difference. But by the time puberty happens, or adolescence especially, then things change considerably. So that's the watershed, and the biological cause of that is the effect of testosterone on the body. So that's why I understood, and I understand why they're looking at that hormone. But again, there's so many complications, and the problem they've got is that the evidence to prove that doesn't stand up to the legal question that's being asked of it.
Okay. Well, let's chart some of that territory then. If we take the Semenya angle, maybe initially, because I think that's how most people who are looking on have interacted with this story over the last number of years. You mentioned 18 years old, comes on the scene in 2009, wins a world championship. Subsequently, the hyperandrogenism is diagnosed and identified. And so it's in 2011 that the IAAF introduced the testosterone limit. Now, interestingly, I see it was 10 nanomoles then, and it's even more restrictive now. They've halved that to 5 this time around.
Yeah.
But in 2011, they cut it to 10. And even at 10 nanomoles after taking medication, Semenya is not the same athlete. She doesn't win in London or the World Championships. I know there was a Russian doping at the time, but she's not the same athlete. So then you mentioned legal issues. So CAS come in. It's challenged by an Indian sprinter, and it's ruled in favour of the Indian sprinter. So Semenya is then free again to race without medication. She has since been unstoppable and brilliant and at her very best. And so here we are heading for November 1st, 2018, where it will be 5 nanomoles. Semenya tweeted, "I'm 97% sure you don't like me. I'm 100% sure I don't care." I saw you saying that what this will mean for Semenya is incredibly drastic, as we might all presume. You know, you were estimating in so much as you can that she might be 5 or 7 seconds slower in the 800 meters.
Yeah, that was, I mean, who knows for sure, but that's based on the history you've just alluded to. So we know that between 2011 and 2015, there were a group of athletes. So Semenya's not the only one. At the 2011 and 13 World Championships, where the IAAF then did these studies, there were 9 athletes who had these conditions, and we know she's one of them. So that leaves 8 basically unaccounted for. So they are there. She's obviously the high profile one by virtue of the leak. And there's no doubt that the lowering of testosterone affects anyone. We know that because almost a parallel issue facing sport now is how does sport deal with transgender females? So that's men who then want to compete in women's sport. And they also take the same medication, which lowers their testosterone. Their limit is also 5, according to the new IOC guideline. And their performance also suffers to more or less the same degree. So that seems to me to be actually a conservative prediction. I wouldn't be surprised if it's even more.
Okay, there's tons of interesting stuff in that. Let's start with the layman, most common, maybe instinctive reaction that we might all have, which is, you know, Usain Bolt has been gifted very naturally with lots of fast twitch muscles and a perfect physique for doing what he does, and we let him do it. Caster Semenya has done nothing illegal. She has been born with these gifts. They are fully natural. So who are we to say, well, in fairness to the other 99% in the women's category, we have to limit somebody who's just naturally gifted? Is the point not of sport here to find the best in the male and female categories? So, I mean, that the Usain Bolt fast twitch argument versus Caster Semenya's testosterone will be, I think, a very instinctive reaction for a lot of people.
It is. And so this has been many people's first response. Tall people benefit enormously from their height for basketball. So should we cut their legs off and shorten them up a bit? So that's the kind of thing that I have heard a good deal. The answer to that, in my opinion, is that we don't have a category for height in basketball. We don't have a category for big feet and long arms in swimming, and nor do we have a category for fast twitch muscle fibers in sprinting. So the question then is, well, why is that? Now, I guess at a philosophical level, one can say that maybe we should have a category for height in basketball. And so let's pursue that. If we decided today, you and I had the authority to do this, and we said from now on, there will be a short person's basketball NBA, and anyone under 1.75 can play in it. So why would we do that? We would do that because we're trying to protect short people, because we recognize that they are at a severe disadvantage in that sport. If we did that justly, then we would have to defend the line between short and tall categories. And so it wouldn't matter if you were 177 because of your parents being taller and genetically you're just too tall. You can't then play down. Now, apply that same argument to men's and women's sport. And sociologists might argue slightly differently, but again, as a physiologist, this is my bias. Women's sport exists for the same reason that we could create short person's basketball, because in the absence of that separation, all the medals, not just the medals, but the top 100, 200, maybe even in some instances 1,000 performances would be men.
Yeah.
Because the influence of that Y chromosome and that testosterone is so powerful that it creates this complete separation between elite men and elite women. So women's sport as a category exists to ensure some degree of fairness. Now, in my opinion, an advantage, whether it's lung volume, arm length, feet size, muscle fiber types, is not an unfair advantage unless it causes a person to move from this side into that side across a categorical divider. Now, that categorical divider exists for men's and women's sport, and that's why, in principle, an advantage that confers on women a high level of testosterone, if they can use that testosterone like a male can, is something that I think needs to be discussed. Mm. It may not be that we all necessarily agree that it needs to be managed in the way that the IWF wishes to do it, but I can understand that once that boundary exists between men's and women's sports, then something has to be done to ensure that it's not crossed. Okay. And it's only unfair when that line is crossed. So the best example is Anthony Joshua weighs 100 kilograms. Is he allowed to fight as a 72 kilogram guy? No, because we've got categories that defend weight. Mm-hmm. The problem is it's very easy to measure weight or height. It's much more difficult to measure sex in a biological sense.
Yeah, and it's very complicated for people, and you can't see it with your eyes. We can look at Joshua and we can look at a much smaller fighter, and it's obvious. And we look at Semenya and she is a woman. And so it's less obvious, and you're relying on things like nanomoles. Now, I whatever metric nanomoles is, I'm not too familiar with it, but I am because of this case. Is it a human rights issue?
To some extent, yes, I think so. If one frames it in that way, though, and as I'm saying this, I realize that people can attack it for being trivializing of human rights. But
yeah,
then you would have to suggest that other athletes also have rights, and so their voice needs to be heard as well. And one thing I'll say, with the experience of having been in South Africa for 9 years, is that you can't raise the possibility that other athletes are at a disadvantage versus Semenya that might be unfair, because then you get shot down for being anti-human rights. But I would argue that those athletes have just as much right to be heard. And I've heard a couple of people saying that there's a lot of fear around talking about that issue.
Yeah.
Now, again, perhaps I'm trivializing human rights. Perhaps it's an issue of sporting rights versus human rights in this regard. And I fully appreciate that. But I can see why it's a human rights thing. But I'm not 100% comfortable with the idea that participating in elite sport is a human right. I mean, we, again, Anthony Joshua has a right to compete in boxing, but he can't compete at a category that he doesn't belong in. So you could apply the same argument to this. It's in Paralympic sport, they have categories for disability, which serve the same function. They protect athletes with more severe disabilities, mm-hmm. and then they try to ensure some degree of fair competition. And there's a right of every single athlete to have that fairness, yeah. as much as one wants to impose it. And I would argue that so too women athletes have that expectation.
Yeah, and so in this instance, testosterone seems to be the guiding light. So there's a few other things. You mentioned different categories. So we have Dr. Stefan Berman, who heads up the IAAF's health and science department, and he was talking when the new rules were announced about being in favour of a third category. So he wants intersex athletes to have their own competition, their own category. He thinks it could happen within 5 years. He says, we have a lot of athletes with this kind of condition. It is not just the one or two people you hear about in the media. In elite female athletics, the number of intersex athletes is 140 times more than what you might find in the normal female population. So is that where we're headed here very quickly? I mean, we're talking about intersex competition reasonably well established within 5 years, do you think?
No, I can't see it for a few reasons, some of which are practical. You know, when he talks about the incidence or the prevalence of them being 140 times greater, that's true, but you've got to remember you're starting off a low base. So that 140 times greater means 9 out of 2,000.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, and I heard somewhere else, there was a stat maybe more recently, it's 7 in 1,000. So that's how many exist, which is a lot more than in the general population, but you can't hold an event where you've got 7 out of 1,000 people. Mm. And then I think even bigger as a barrier is that people would have to self-declare, because the authorities aren't going to say you and you're intersex, the rest of you can go men. So you're going to ask people to self-declare. And if you just look at the reaction to this discussion, no one in their right mind would declare themselves and say, hi there, I'm intersex, yeah. and I'd like to compete in the third category. I wish we could be so tolerant and then there were enough of them, but I think we are, I think we're decades away from that.
Yeah, I think anyone would look at the discussion around Semenya over the last number of years and would not sign up for that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
To give a flavour, Seb Coe was saying that the IAAF have done this. They must ensure a level playing field where success is determined by talent and dedication and hard work. We want athletes to be incentivised to make the huge commitment and sacrifice required. You mentioned the legality of all that, of all this, and that's where it gets very interesting. So we've seen CAS overturn this before. CAS told IAAF to go off and do research on this and come up with evidence to show that high testosterone makes this key significant difference. And Berman, the doctor I mentioned, it seems he analysed samples from male and female athletes at the 2011 and 13 World Championships, and he found a 5.7 percentage on average increase in their performance, or decrease rather, in their performance. Different sides of the same coin. So 5.7% he found to be the difference. So on the issue of why this is so narrow, this window, on the one hand, I've heard it very reasonably suggested that to go from, 400 metres up to a mile is purely just to deal with the Caster Semenya situation, because that's almost drawing so much attention and they have targeted her. I have also heard it say that the research that Berman and the IAAF have done specifically looks at these disciplines and these distances, and that's why the IAAF have initially started with targeting these disciplines, because they feel legally they have the best amount of evidence, even if it seems in the hammer testosterone is of more value to you than in these particular disciplines. So that's a long-winded question, but I'm looking here and wondering if they have targeted Semenya because it's a very uncomfortable situation when she keeps winning all these races, or if actually the targeting of these distances is to do their level best to stop CAS overturning the new rules and then everybody being back to square one.
Yeah, so in South Africa, everyone's convinced it's targeted, of course.
Yeah.
They're calling it the Semenya law. The explanation and the reason I don't think that's the case is that you might recall in 2015, when CAS ruled on the Duty Chand case, they were very clear about two things. Number one is that the burden of proof lay with the IAAF. In other words, it was the IAAF's problem to first establish that the advantage was unfair and then they could have the policy, not the other way around. Okay, so that pretty much, as I think is often the case, that pretty much decided that case, because the IAAF needed to produce evidence for the advantage, yeah, and they didn't have it. So the second point was CAS said, right, go away and bring us the evidence. So what the IAAF did is they looked at all the events from 100 meters all the way to the marathon, including all the field events. And at the 2011 and the 2013 World Championships, they looked at every single woman's testosterone level and their performance, and they divided them into top third, middle third, bottom third for testosterone. So they asked the question, do the woman with the highest testosterone perform better than the woman with the lowest testosterone? And the answer to that question, as you go down the events, is no, no, yes, for 400, right? So for 100 and 200, no effect. And because CAS had basically told the IAAF, you can have a policy if you have the evidence,
yeah,
the IAAF cannot now add the 100 and 200 because there's no evidence at all. But they do have evidence for four. They've got evidence for 400 hurdles, and they had evidence for 800. So that's why those three events are there. Mm-hmm. The mystery and the dispute, and this is where the IAAF starts to, I think, skate on thin ice a little bit, is that they've added the 1500, even though their own evidence suggested no difference between those two groups. And they haven't added the hammer throw and the pole vault, even though their evidence did suggest. So that opens them up to the accusation that it's specific to Semenya. But I don't think that's the case. I find it, and I mean, we've spoken about sports governance and corruption, and so perhaps I shouldn't be so naive, but I find it incredible to think that there's a group of doctors and lawyers and officials saying, how do we target one athlete? Yeah. Nobody would be that stupid in this controversial issue. So the reason, the short answer for this narrow range of events is because those are the only events where they've got evidence, because they know that without that evidence, CAS is saying, thanks for coming, get out of here again.
Yeah, okay, very interesting. Yeah. And do you think, Ross, that it's only a matter of time before the IAAF, let's presume they go to, this will be challenged again somewhere along the,
almost
the line.
Almost certainly, yeah.
So let's presume they've built up enough evidence to convince CAS. And that I presume is a question mark, and feel free to give your thoughts on that. Is it then just a matter of time before the IAAF managed to establish the evidence in more and more and more and more events? Like, will there come a time, do you presume, where in the 100 metres they will find the evidence, and we'll see this right across all female disciplines?
I suspect not. And the reason I say that is that I don't think the evidence they've got is strong enough either. If you read that original CAS decision, and it makes really interesting reading, the number of times that CAS talk about 10 to 12%. Now, why is that? That's because that's the typical difference between the best men and the best women. And at least half a dozen times in the verdict, CAS talks about the size of the advantage, 10 to 12, 10 to 12, 10 to 12. I think that CAS were setting a bar. They were saying that if you want a policy, you've got to show us that the advantage of testosterone is close to, maybe not exactly, but close to that 10 to 12%. And what their evidence shows is between 2 and 4% in those specific events. So I think that their research is actually quite weak. Okay. And I'm sympathetic to them, because I think that the question that they tried to answer is impossible. There is no ethical study that you can do to answer the question that the courts made them answer. The only good study is unethical, and the only ethical studies are not good. So they were in an impossible situation, the IAAF, and they've done, I think, some will say they haven't, some will say they've been actually downright dishonest, but I think they've done what they can do, but I would be very surprised if it's good enough. And if it's not good enough in the events where you've already got these athletes winning races, then I would be very surprised that anything in the future shows an effect at 100, 200, 5,000, 10,000. So
okay,
my prediction would be that this current policy doesn't stand up to challenge, because I think the evidence is weak. And if that's the case, then where do they go? I see no further avenues for them at this stage.
Right, we're back to square one. I appreciate your point about this whole issue that they have to do something, that actually from a physiological point of view, it is unfair on the 99% of women trying to compete against somebody with Semenya's physiology. say Cass shoots this down and say the IAAF and everybody thinks, you know what, this is too hard. We're picking too arbitrary a line. It's 5 nanomoles this year. It's 10 nanomoles the last year. You know, it's a mess. Is there an argument that, well, we just have to sit out Semenya's career and she cleans up the division and you won't see the like of her again for another 10 years or 20 or 30 years and this will crop up once a lifetime and we just live with it? Or actually, are we going to see more and more Semenyas, or is it impossible to tell?
It's impossible to tell. If Cass knocks this policy down, yeah, like they did the previous one, then that's probably what the IAAF will be hoping.
Okay.
You know, so they will be hoping that this, what would effectively amount to permanent removal of the policy, doesn't open up the floodgates for women's sport to be overrun by athletes like this. And I've seen people saying that it would be the end of women's athletics. I think that's a little bit of exaggeration. There's a bit of hyperbole in that, because these conditions are not common enough that you're suddenly going to have 500 athletes at the 2024 Olympic Games with this condition. It just doesn't happen often enough, you know. So I don't think that it would be the death knell of women's competition. I think there's maybe a little bit of emotion in the opposite direction there. But
yeah,
the IAAF will obviously be disappointed, because they're sort of caught up in the middle. They're trying to manage two opposing incentives or desires. And so they would just be hoping that it doesn't become more of a problem for them than it would be from the next, I don't know, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. And I, as you said, there's no way of predicting. That's all very interesting. Hey, maybe that even, maybe if it's not going to open the floodgates, maybe that strengthens the argument in some people's minds that you just sit back and say, well, this is, and I mean this in totally respectful, right way, like a genetic freak in the same way that Bolt is, and you just appreciate it for what it is.
You,
I mean,
yeah, you can say then you basically would be saying that this is a once every three generations athlete.
Yes.
Who goes through basically their entire career unbeatable, and then they retire and you bring in the next one, you know, and that's not uncommon. I mean, in swimming, Katie Ledecky might be that person. Michael Phelps, you could argue, was that person. Bolt, for how many years was it? 8 years, was probably that person. So that's, and again, I'm agnostic, if you want to put it that way, as to what that means, you know, and I don't particularly mind, but I can see both sides of the argument. And that's probably the best case scenario for those who think that it's unfair. They're just going to have to say, you know what, for the next 10 years or 5 years, that's just the way it is. And then we'll move on from there.
A very, very last point. Sometimes we neglect the human side of this. So I don't know much about Semenya as a person, actually. I don't think I've ever really seen her do a long form interview or give too much of herself. What kind of person is she? How has she dealt with the furore which has surrounded so much of her career?
I think when she first emerged, you know, she was the subject of an incredibly invasive discussion in 2009 as a very young woman. And in South Africa, it was politicized like you won't believe. The politicians met them at the airport and people were making comments that were just cringeworthy. And I think for the first year or two, she really lost the way a little bit, because she was badly managed, I think. But since then, I think she's managed to pull that together. And she has won over so many people just for her attitude. I think she has, you know, she's given a couple of interviews at Olympic Games and World Championships in the past where she doesn't address the controversy head on, but I think she handles herself with like tremendous grace and dignity in the face of what she must be aware are questions and speculation that no one wants to deal with. So I think as an icon for progressive thinking and gender rights and so forth, she will probably go down in history as incredibly influential.
Yeah.
And obviously you're going to get people that are just snide and cruel and harsh and maybe ignorant. But I think most people, even those who think that this is maybe unfair if she competes, most people would say that she's actually a class act and that there's no issue with her as a person. Right. She's done nothing but, in my opinion, and maybe her critics would sound biased, but in my opinion, she's done nothing but handle this thing like with the most incredible grace and poise. I'm amazed she continued to run, never mind that she's been so successful. It's actually remarkable.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Hey, just one last one then, as you're talking, which occurred to me. Do we know what her testosterone levels are and how might they compare, if we do, to what's going on in men's elite races?
We don't. We know that in 2011, when the IAAF did that study, they identified at those World Championships, there were 5 athletes who had these conditions. and the lowest of them had a testosterone concentration of 15, and the highest was a 29.6. And we know she was in those world champs. So she's one of those five between 15 and 29. The men's range ran from 10 up to about 40. So those ranges overlap. But I couldn't tell you whether she was the 15 or the 30. We just don't know.
Yeah. And a lot of elite women would be as low as 3.
Yeah. So 99% of women at those world championships were below 3.1.
Okay. Right.
And there were five athletes who had these DSDs, among whom is Castus Menya. And then at those world champs, there were five athletes who were doping as well, who had elevated testosterone levels.
Okay. Listen, thank you for taking us through all that. I know it's very complicated and tricky business. Dr. Ross Tucker, scienceofsport.com is where people can check out your work. Pleasure as always. Thanks very much.
Sure. No, thank you. Always good chatting. Ciao.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.